Hello, welcome to What the CF, a Cystic Fibrosis podcast. I'm Ingrid Grenard and this is episode 15. And in this episode, I have a great chat with Bella Powell. Now, in New Zealand, most people will know who Bella is. She's a young woman with cystic fibrosis and she was the first, I believe, to take Trikafta here in New Zealand. She had it gifted to her from Sir Bob Elliott in the last months of his life. This story was broken by Patrick Gower, who I interviewed in the previous episode. So if you haven't listened to that episode, listen to the Bella episode, listen to the Paddy episode. They're linked together and you'll get a whole vibe of how this story really captured the hearts of New Zealand and made the awareness of CF and the need for Trikafta so huge from a very small community that we have over here. Now, Bella is so articulate and authentic and honest and emotional in this interview. She talks about her childhood with CF. She talks about her relationship with Bob, getting Trikafta, the life-changing benefits that she saw and the career she's now built in theatre. And she's now over in Australia working in Worldcast Productions over there. So I really hope you enjoy this episode. It's absolutely brilliant. She's brilliant. She deserves all the success in the world. And yeah, I really hope you enjoy it. Now, remember, if you do like the podcast and you'd like to support us, please go to buymeacoffee.com/WTCFpod. You can always visit our website, whatthecf.com. You can find us on Instagram at whatthecfpod. You can find us on Facebook at What the CF, a Cystic Fibrosis Podcast, and you can also email us on wtcfpod@gmail.com. Please let me know what you think of the episodes. I love getting your messages, and so you can email or you can message us on Facebook or Instagram, and I always get back to you, and I just really appreciate any messages that I get. You could also please follow us on Spotify, rate us on Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts. If you want to leave a review, that would be even more wonderful. If you are enjoying the podcast, then we'd really appreciate that. So without further ado, it's time to listen to Bella Powell on What the CF. Enjoy. Hello, welcome to What the CF and welcome to Bella Powell, who is my guest on today's episode. Hi, Bella.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad. A little bit frazzled, as usual, trying to get everything done. But if you hear any sort of random noises, obviously there's lots of repair work going on in Auckland at the moment. So there are workmen around the area. So random power tool noise is all that kind of stuff. There's not much we can do about that. So Bella is quite well known to the New Zealand CF community, as she was one of the strongest voices as patient advocate for Trikafta when we were going through the campaign to fund Trikafta, which is now going to be happening this year. So Bella became sort of the face, I guess, or one of the main faces for CF to help build awareness around what CF meant and the life-changing effects of Trikafta. So I thought, Bella, maybe if you do a little intro of yourself and life growing up with CF, what it was like in your childhood and the experiences that you had.
Yeah, awesome. How much time do you have? So let's go right back to the beginning of my journey with CF, because I am in no way the worst off person with CF, but I did have my fair few challenges growing up. So while my mom was still pregnant with me, during one of her scans, it showed that I had a bowel obstruction. And that's when the alarm bells started to go off that there's probably something else going wrong with me. And of course, both my parents were tested for the CF gene and both of them came back as carriers. Then I was born. I was born via cesarean because that was the only way it could happen. And I had a do not resuscitate order straight off the bat when I was born, because if I didn't come out crying, it was going to be an uphill battle to try and save me, because the obstruction was very large and very fragile at that point. And if it had popped, I would have lost my battle right then and there, but I didn't. I came out screaming and I was driven to Starship Hospital, wrapped in literally cotton wool and bubble wrap, 5Ks an hour, got me to Starship, 13-hour operation by one of the most amazing surgeons I ever got to know, Vipalu Padiay, and he removed 2/3 of my small intestine. Mm-hmm. And then I spent the next year of my life recovering in Starship And that was kind of the turbulent, like, beginning to my story. And then the first 2-3 years of my life, I was pretty normal. And then the infection started and my gut failed. And I've been in and out of hospital my entire life with that, recurring lung infections, bowel infections. And it wasn't until I was about 12 that my lung function started to really take a turn to start going down again. I have a MACE infection in my lungs, which is, I'm not going to say antibiotic resistant because that's the wrong word, but it has been a struggle to keep it under control. And that was definitely one of the things that did really impact my lung function and one of the reasons I did decline so early. I was spending about 6 months out of a year in Starship Hospital every year for as long as I can remember. I went to school in Starship. I got dressed for my formals and my like school dances on the Starship ward. The nurses did my hair and my makeup and I went out and then had to be back at 6 a.m. the next morning to get more antibiotics or do my physio sessions. Yeah, it's such a, there's so many things. It's a whirlwind of things that happened to me. It's hard to like.
That's like a full extended family at hospital when you're spending that much time there. Mm. Kind of like part of the furniture, not a piece of furniture you want to be.
I was definitely part of the furniture. We called ourselves lifers, ones who were recurring in and out, recurring characters on the soap opera, which could have been Starship or 26B. It was all of us all the time, grew up together. I've got a lot of close friends who we met on the ward and we've stayed in contact, and I was one of the older ones because it was kind of a bubble of us that came through, a bubble of CF patients who sort of were all born around the same time. So we were sort of, well, we didn't know each other, but we all kind of like looked at each other down the hall and they're like, hey, I know what you have. I have that too. Yeah. And then tried to avoid each other. But we all, I call some of the other people we met, they're my little brothers, they're my little sisters, they're, because you're so close, because that's all you see for months on end is these core group of people.
And also, you know, no one else would really understand what it's like to have a long stay in hospital unless you've had a long stay in hospital, especially as a child, when, you
yeah,
know,
I remember
how
trying
much
to explain to my friends at school.
So how,
and they were just like, oh, you just don't show up for months on end. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know what else to tell you. I'm sick. I can't be here.
Yeah. And so that's a difficult conversation to have as a child, because obviously your parents would have the discussions with the school and all that stuff. But when you're just with your peers, how did you, maybe when you're younger, because we know how you do it now, which is really excellently, how did you communicate your CF, or how much did you communicate to friends? And did you form friendships outside like that sort of hospital bubble that could empathise more with you? And how did that work?
Yeah, so I have different bits and bobs. I have a Mickey button, I have a port. I often had pick lines. Growing up, there was, even when I was at school, there were very visible reminders to people that I wasn't like all the other girls and boys. I had different things wrong with me, and I had my Mickey button from when I was 4 to help with my nutrition. Having a third of a small intestine does make weight gain, which it is a struggle for all people with CF, but when you don't have the surface area to absorb anything in the first place, it definitely makes it harder. So I remember, I think it was my year 0 class, my home care nurse came in one day and we did the whole like, this is a Mickey button, and the kids got to like play with it. And what is it? What makes Bella who she is? And kids are so flexible. They don't see those sorts of things as being issues. They're like, oh, that's funny.
Yeah,
let's go play Barbies. Like that was.
That's a cool thing to know. But I don't know what it is. What is it?
So a Mickey button. It is a G tube essentially. So it goes into my stomach. It's permanent. there I used to be on overnight feeds every night. Just me and weight have had a very complex relationship. It's something that I don't hear talked about often with people with CF, is just how hard it is to gain weight and maintain weight. I've had stints in hospital when my guts failed and I've lost over half of my body weight very, very quickly and had to climb that uphill battle just to get myself back to a healthy baseline. And like the fear around being small and going into clinic and getting weighed, because as I got older, it was those sorts of things that started, especially in a school environment, people started to realize, oh, Bella is actually sick, when I would turn up to school and I'd be a lot smaller than I used to be. Or as I got older, my lungs started getting worse and I couldn't play hockey and I couldn't play netball anymore and I had to start taking more of a back seat. But I've had a really close core group of friends for pretty much my entire way through school who, you know, stood with me and by me and helped me through a lot of that things. There definitely were challenges, especially going into the teenage years, because, you know, people change and those years are so hard for everyone. And when you've got people like me who are struggling with things that are so completely different from what every other teenager was struggling with, there definitely was times where I had friends and people, I did find it difficult. And I withdrew myself quite a lot during that time because I 14, I was on the transplant track and starting to go that way already. So I kind of sunk back into myself and tried to protect the people around me from what was going on and how I was actually feeling, as a way of just trying to stay normal and trying to stay in that normal age category. It wasn't until I got on Trikafta and I could breathe again and I could rejoin my life and sort of reconnect with me as a person and not me as a sick person, that I could really like take advantage of that again and like be myself and be a part of the things that were going on in my life.
Because that's kind of the struggle, is being identified, although I introduced you as kind of the face of CF for this campaign, but being identified as CF and not Bella is the thing that every teenager would despise, because you want to be a person, individual, and finding your own way and not be marked by something that makes you stand out, or, you know, makes people see you as other or different or anything like that. And so seeing that you would retreat like that makes perfect sense, and is also sad, you know, to miss out on those times. But at the same time, you don't know any different in your body, do you? Like, you've got CF, you've had it your whole life, and you've had all this roller coaster happen to you. Mm-hmm. So the last episode we talked to Patrick Gower and about how he first heard about CF and about Trikafta and what it could do, and the amazing interviews that he did with Sir Bob Elliott and yourself. And I wondered if you could tell me the story from your side of meeting Patrick Gower for the first time and telling that story, because obviously at the point that you met him, quite a lot had already happened for you.
Yeah, so when I was 15, I had my first transplant meeting, and in that meeting, I didn't know what I was walking into. And, you know, I was sat down and told very bluntly, which I think is the only way you can tell a person that sort of news, that I had 2 years, probably less, if nothing changed. And, you know, I was sitting in that room with my mum, my dad, my two older sisters, and they were all crying. And I had to sort of like within a split second take notice of my emotions and what was going on, and just, okay, this is what the next chapter of my journey is. My next chapter of my journey is this is a transplant, and that's a very scary thing to be looking at, especially as a 15-year-old. And so that was 2019 on my 16th birthday. I went active. It was a very odd 16th birthday. I was doing different tests on that day to get onto the list. And then we had a meeting right before. My mum had organised a surprise party at home, and her way of keeping me out of the house was taking me to Green Lane Hospital to have a transplant meeting.
Only in a CF world would that happen.
Only in a CF world on your 16th birthday will you be in a transplant meeting. So, and they told me I went active, and then from that point on, for almost the next 2 years, anytime the phone rang, my heart stopped thinking, is this my lungs? Is this
today? Yeah.
Is this the thing that's going to save me? And then, of course, we're in 2020. We're all at home. And I had gotten very good at hiding how bad I was, how bad my lungs were. Because mum would go to work and the girls would go to work and school and I would go to school. And then I could come home and be like, oh, I just had a really long day. Like, that's why I'm tired. That's why I'm going to bed early. Or, you know, like retreat in different ways. But when we're all home, you know, and I've got two older sisters, there's four women in a house, and you can't hide.
There's no hiding, no.
So that's when I think the realization for my family, and not so much for me, I had spent a lot of time thinking about, if this is the end for me, what have I done, trying to like know myself before I didn't have time to figure that stuff out and do it all very quickly. And I, during that time in 2020, early 2020, I was very at peace with the fact that this, it didn't look like I was going to get lungs because of my size. I'm a small person and I was essentially waiting for teens to die so that I could have a second shot, which is heartbreaking to think about. And I was very at peace that this is the end of my road. I've done the most that I can, and now I've just got to enjoy the small moments that I can still make the best of.
And it's so much to have, so much to have on your shoulders. Like you say, you're effectively waiting for someone else to pass away for you to carry on your life. And actually, I spoke quite a lot. I did an episode with Lizzie, who had a lung transplant at 19.
Yes.
And just, you know, talking about that relationship, or just that relationship with the donor that you will have for the rest of your life is very complex. And you're so young as well when you're dealing with all these different emotions that you're having to deal with.
Yeah.
So that's so much to be taken in, on as such a young person.
Yeah, and then me and Bob have had a close relationship for years. Bob Elliott.
So had he known you since you were born? Bob?
He had followed me since I was born. My case had always been a bit of a medical mystery. I had, you know, gotten infections, or, you know, I was born with a bowel obstruction and then had 2/3 of my small intestine removed at birth. And then I had bouts with pneumonia and different very weird and wonderful lung infections. And I most of the time seemed to come out of it okay, and I bounced back quite a few times before I stopped bouncing back quite as well. So he had followed my case for a while, and then I became a Cure Kids ambassador when I was 9. And of course, Cure Kids was one of his passion projects and his charity. So I got to know him through that, and he became like a grandfather to me. I got to know his kids and his wife. And, you know, we would see each other at CF events or Cure Kids events. And he would always sit me down and ask me what antibiotics I was on and ask me about my lung function and my weight chart. And he was always very
interested.
He kept an eye on me. Yeah.
So I should just probably say for listeners outside of New Zealand that Sir Bob Elliott, who passed away a couple of years ago, he dedicated his life to cystic fibrosis and childhood illness, and he invented the heel prick test, which we all know today, which is for all newborns and newborn screening and so on. So
Bob was the godfather of CF. Of CF care, of CF research. He, fabulous man who dedicated his entire life to making the lives of people with CF and with other life-threatening chronic illnesses better. And, you know, every time I talk about him, I start to feel like I'm going to cry. So I'm just going to get through this bit.
That's okay. Me and Paddy pretty much just sat in a room crying for an hour the other week because it's very emotional what happened next, really. So
yeah, so Bob got in touch with my mum and said, hey, there's this drug. And I had been sat down in a room when I was four and had people tell me, so, you know, you're never going to be cured. You're never going to know a life where your CF doesn't limit you. If you make it to 18, fabulous. If you make it past then, you know, good job. You know, you're probably never going to get married or have kids or have a career. Or like, I had been living with that information since I was four. And like,
That's a lot for a four-year-old.
Yeah, I was a little girl who loved like princesses and fairy tales, but I knew deep down my entire life that I was never going to have that magical transformation and, you know, get to live my happily ever after sort of thing. So when Mum said, hey, Bob's got in touch, he's found it. He thinks he's found it. And I had been Bob's guinea pig for years. He had come up with so many weird and wonderful things that he thought was going to help. He was a big supporter of A2 milk. He thought A2 milk was going to save the world for a while.
Yeah.
He had an episode where he was like, nah, it's squid skin. Squid skin's got the cure. So, and when he came to the next one, I was like, oh, he's at it again.
He's trying another one. Yeah.
At the same time, Bob was not someone you said no to. I had never said no to him because I knew he was always onto something. Even if it wasn't the big one, he was always onto something. And me and Bob were on the same track. At this point, both of us were in palliative care. He, of course, had leukemia. Me, of course, waiting on the transplant list and very, very aware that that was probably not going to happen for me. So we took a leap of faith with Bob, trusted him. And him and my doctors got in a room, they sorted it out, found a supply of it, got in touch with Vertex, and Bob invested $100,000 in purchasing 3 months for me to try, for me to take a second leap, take a second sort of like swing in the game. And yeah, it was
because we'd not heard of Trikafta at all. Like the first I heard of Trikafta was when it was on the news with your story that Paddy did. Mm, that was the only way to get it was for someone to pay.
The only way to get it was to self-fund and to self-purchase. So it was, I think the thing that stuck out to me was we had purchased it. It was on its way. And one of the moments that does stick with me so much about that sort of first few days was Bob had sent a message to my mum saying when we weren't sure if we were going to get it, we weren't sure if this was the right way to go, he said, Bella and I can't go at the same time. This is not how it works. Bella deserves to have a life outside of this. And the amount of faith that man had in me that I not only deserved to have another shot at life, but he so wanted me to and had such faith in me. And it was just the type of love that not many people get to experience. And I'm so incredibly grateful that he was that person for me. He was my guardian angel. And we got the call one random Tuesday morning saying, hey, it's here. Hey, it's in the hospital. It was in a vault. It cost so much money. It was in one of the big med lockups. And we, you know, I don't think I had moved so fast in years.
All the logistics to get that there.
I grabbed my mum. I forced her into the car. I was like, I don't care if you want to finish your coffee. We're going now. We got in the car. We got there. We picked up the boxes and I like clutched it. I was like, no one's touching it.
Yeah.
No one's getting near it.
Could you take it at home or did you have to be in hospital to start?
No, I was allowed to take it at home. We went to my sister's coffee shop and she gave me a coffee. And because you have to take it with some sort of fatty food, just helps with the absorption.
Yeah.
So she gave me like a bowl of ice cream and I ate a bowl of ice cream and I had a coffee and then I swallowed it. And I was very much still in the camp where I don't think this is going to work, but it will be a funny story. And then my body crashed. I think I'd been like building up this moment for weeks at this point and I just fell asleep. And then I woke up sort of 6 hours later.
Would your mum have been worried? I've been so worried something had gone wrong. I was like, is drowsiness aside? I'd be really terrified.
It was also so new. Like there wasn't a whole heap of research when I'd started it about
its effects. It's scary.
And it was scary.
But probably not as scary as what you were facing anyway. So may as well.
It wasn't as scary. So I was like, it'll be fine. We'll be cool. The she'll be right attitude was definitely going on. And I woke up that 6 hours later and I sat up and it was kind of like the light lifted from behind my eyes and I took a breath and I actually felt oxygen entering my lungs for the first time in 16, almost 17 years. And I got out of bed, ran out into my kitchen and I told the entire family to shut up and just listen to me take a breath because it was something that they hadn't ever heard me do because, you know, I breathed really shallow and in the top of my chest and I would chuff a lot because I was trying to stop coughing. So I'd always take a breath and then go and then like try and just keep going.
Yeah.
And I sat down and I had a conversation with my family without stopping and without having to stop to catch my breath.
Just all these things that we take for granted are those of us who don't have CF, just how much every single aspect of your life is affected in that sense of how you have a conversation, how you laugh, how you tell a story is affected by that's amazing.
Yeah, and then the next week we had what is now affectionately known with people who have started Trikafta as the purge.
Yes, I think Ed called it that.
Everything that has been sitting in your lungs for years, it is
gross.
Imagine Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
It's disgusting. It's awful. But it's like when you like deep clean your house after a while and it's like, wow, this is so lovely. That's the same sort of deep clean that lungs. You have in your lungs. It's like, wow, they're clean and I can walk around and not have to cough and splutter everywhere.
I feel like that's quite a good mental preparation for what's happening to your body. That mentally you actually see something.
Yeah.
So it's almost like that's what it was and this is where I am. Like you can actually see something happening, especially with CF being referred to as invisible to so many people. Yeah. It certainly isn't for you. And then you actually get to see what's been in there, which is not nice.
It was that first nebulizer. My mum and my sisters like came into the room. They're like, what have you got out of your lungs? And it kind of became like a whole, like, I'm pretty sure mum took pictures of some of it. Mum was like, oh my God, this is so cool. And I'm like, no, we don't need this to be documented. That first month was just stride after stride of things getting better.
Did that help with your with weight gain at the beginning? Or will you always have that struggle anyway? Even if with Trikafta,
I was definitely still, when I started Trikafta, on a very like thin tightrope with weight, I would slip off every now and again. But as soon as I got on the Trikafta, my lungs weren't working as hard. Just do the simple things in a day, my weight did come on and it did. I did begin maintaining weight a lot easier than I used to. Like, I am still a very little person. Like, I'm only 5 foot tall, so, like, I'm petite, I'm little. But I was maintaining my weight for the first time ever, and I was, you know, in the bracket of weight where they were like, no, you're okay, for the first time, possibly in my entire life. So that was, I'm pretty sure my mum, when we got home from that clinic appointment, that first clinic appointment, my mum popped a bottle of champagne, and we did it, guys. Like, it was definitely like party central and the powerhouse after that first clinic. That first clinic, though, was the scariest thing because, of course, I felt so much better, but we didn't know if the numbers reflected it. So we didn't know if it was just the placebo thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I didn't know anyone else on Trikafta at that point, so we were still very in a very isolated experience.
And were you in touch with Bob, you know, throughout this on the phone to say, oh, this is happening, this is how I'm feeling? Like, what was – he must have been over the moon.
There was a pretty big email thread of us because I so wanted to see him. I wanted to, like, go and see him and tell him all about what was going on, but he very much – he didn't want to see me. He didn't want my last memories of him to be him.
Yeah.
Sick.
Yeah.
So he was over the moon with it all. And it was sort of just before that first clinic is when I did that interview with Patty, that first interview. And I just remember Mum going, oh, hey, you remember that guy who swore on the news? And I was like, oh, yeah, he was great. We had posters for him to be prime minister all around our school. Mum's like, oh, he's coming to interview you. And I'm like, oh, why? Like, why am I getting interviewed? He was like, oh, Bob made him come and do it after he got knighted. And I was like, of course he did. Don't say no to Bob. I could just imagine Bob. He was so sick during his knighting ceremony, but fully stopping Patty and going, hey, you're going to interview her and you're going to do it tomorrow. And you're going to interview me as well. And I think it was 2 days from when that happened to when I was interviewed. It was so incredibly quick. And like that day I had fake nails on and I'd broken a nail and I was like, Mum, I'm leaving school early to get my nails done for this interview.
Because I'm going to be on TV.
It's important to Bob, so it's important to me. And I sat down and Patty walked through the door and I think he sat me down. He was like, I'm not mincing words. We're going to talk about this and we're going to talk about it candidly. And I'm like, okay. And his first question was like, so you're dying? And I was like, okay, we're starting here.
Yeah, straight into
it. And so for anyone who's seen that interview, it was hugely emotional. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the first time I'd ever really been able to speak very candidly about my experience with CF.
It must have been a shock for a lot of people that knew you to understand the extent of what you'd gone through.
I had people who I had been seeing for that past 2 years and people who I'd been friends with for ages going, oh, wait, you're actually like really sick. And I was like, yeah, like there's been so much that I tried to hide. And I think for a lot of people, that was such an eye-opening thing that, you know, even if people are looking normal, that there is so much that can be going on under the surface. And
that they won't tell you that it's going on. Because
and that they won't tell you.
You don't always want to have that conversation.
I had two trusted friends who I told that I was on the transplant list. And the rest knew I was unwell, but I didn't let them into that side of it. And
like these conversations that we're having today, like they're exhausting for everybody because it's emotional, it's hard to talk about.
And back to
nobody wants to nobody wants to have to do that more than they need to. I do really appreciate you sharing all of it again because it's so important for people to understand the story of how we got here in New Zealand. And like my son, I'm trying to think when that story came out, but my son would have been a baby, like newly diagnosed. And we were diagnosed when we were told that, you know, when I said, oh, so what do we do? What the treatment? What are the drugs? Just assuming there's a treatment for this thing. And they were like, oh, no, there isn't anything. Like, you know, that's really got to me that now that conversation is completely different for parents that get that diagnosis. But our first, like, idea that there was something was that story. So it was, we were just like, what? And then they said how much it cost. So, you know, such an amazing thing that you did sharing your story.
That was sort of one of the main things I went into that interview wanting to do because I remember being 8 or 9 and sitting in the clinic waiting room and seeing these new parents coming in and maybe it's their first bubble, their second, and they've just found out their kid has CF. And with the journey I had and like growing up on a ward, I learned a lot of what the big formative life moments for me happened on that ward. Like I learned to ride a bike and first friendships, my first crush was someone on the other end of the ward. Like it was just like all those like very formative moments in a child life I did there. And I just, I looked at these kids, like me sitting in a mask on the other end of the clinic, and I just was like, you don't know how bad it's gonna get. But I always knew I didn't want them to have the experience I had, because no child, no person should have to experience what I did. And going into that interview, in the back of my mind, I knew that there are going to be families out there who have just had their first kid with CF.
Yeah, that would be us. What was the reaction from your point of view?
The reaction was, because at that point when I had started Trikafta, we were under the thing where I'm going to be on this for 3 months, and then that is going to end, and then I'm going to go back to how it was. I definitely went into the interview not thinking that the response to it was going to be what it was. I was very much, I'm doing this for the awareness. I'm doing this because while I am here and I have the voice, I can put the wheels in motion so that this can be the reality for future generations with CF. Not, there wasn't really, I don't remember any thought of this is, I'm doing this to save me. Because at that point, I was still very at peace with the fact that my story was in its final chapters. Mm-hmm. And the interview went live, and I put out a post on my, because I didn't have Instagram at that point. I think I put a thing out on my Snapchat story to my friend and said, hey, I'm on the news with Patty Gower. No context. I just put a picture of me and Patty and just did like three news or news hub, 7 p.m. And we sat and we watched the interview, and, you know, I bawled on national TV, and I bawled watching Bob, because that was honestly the first time I'd seen
what he
looked like in such a long time. And then I remember I went to bed and I woke up the next morning and Mum was like, it's everywhere. Like, it was playing on news sites in Europe, and it was here, there, and everywhere, and we were getting messages, and Patty was calling us saying that people are trying to get in contact with you, and my sister was like, you need Instagram. She set me up an Instagram within, like, 2 hours. We were flooded with messages of people just being so excited that the day we had all been told was never going to come, and the day we never thought was going to happen is happening, and that moment is beginning. Mm-hmm. And it was just such a surreal thing. And I sat there, and even if I didn't reply to every message, I read every single thing that was sent to us. And just hearing the stories of young people with CF or parents with toddlers and bubs who are like, I now don't have to explain to my child that their life is not going to be the same as their brothers or their sisters. And I can be a mum and not a CF mum now. And their siblings can be siblings and not the sibling of a child with CF, which I know is something that my sisters really struggled with, because I took priority sometimes in our lives because I was the one who needed the support. I was the one who needed the care, and, you know, Mum would be in hospital with me and not with my sisters. And like, it definitely does put strain on families. And to hear that sort of come through, that it is just so much bigger than just the person with CF. Like, Trikafta is essentially a symptomatic cure for cystic fibrosis, but you look at the entire picture, that is friends, families, siblings, it affects everyone so much. And then Patty messaged saying, hey, people want to help you. People want to keep you on it. And I didn't know what to do. My life was never worth any more than anyone else's. And I was really conflicted with it. I was like, do I want to stay on it? Yes, but I felt so bad taking money to just keep me on it, knowing that everyone else couldn't have the same experience. Mm-hmm. And I think it was Patty who who said it, he was like, I know, I see how you can feel that way, and it is totally valid. But the people who also need it are not well enough to advocate for it themselves. They need someone who can be there, who can advocate for the drug, for getting it funded, and you've put the ball into motion, and now you have the option to keep it going, keep it rolling, keep moving forward, and put the pressure on so that it can be everyone, and it can be everyone sooner.
And it is very important to have walking, talking, you know, Trikafta patients, you know, CF patients with taking Trikafta, because it does have to be seen to be believed, because of the array of symptoms that CF causes and how different it is for so many people. And it helps that you know, the people that really came through were so articulate, like yourself and Ed. The fact that you were able to engage people and tell your story so well, which you're still doing so well, and getting the key messages across. Not everybody can do that. It was obviously meant to be for this to happen, because you were able to tell that story and so powerfully.
It all comes back to Bob. He saw something in me, and that man could have run a country. I think that country would have been very successful. Yeah, so then the interview blew up, and then we had the Give a Little, and that was the most insane thing. I had family friends who did like Run for a Cure, or there was a Bake for Bella thing where friends of my sister's did a raffle and then made a cake and gave it to someone. My kindy crush did a fundraiser at a school. I hadn't seen him in years. Sorry for putting that on a podcast, but it's okay. I haven't seen him since, so it's fine. It was.
And so that was all to help fund you to continue to take Trikafta.
To continue to take Trikafta.
And so with, obviously, there's that initial kind of blow up of the story. And at the time, you're also still dealing with actually this new life that you're now seeing that you didn't know you were going to have.
Adjusting to that was obviously one of the hardest things.
Yeah. I mean, it's a whole it's a lot to take in. Like you said, you'd grown up thinking, I'm not going to have this happily ever after. I'm not going to have, you know, do these things in my life. And suddenly now, and then you're told, okay, you may not be here. And if you get these lungs, and if that, and if this, and then suddenly everything's different. That's a whole new thing.
it was like, suddenly I could picture a future, and I could let myself picture a future and start to forge a path, and where I can have realistic hopes and dreams and goals and things to work towards. And it was weird, because I was finally joining my peers.
Yeah.
And it, like, they're like,
oh, a lot of life to catch up on, really.
I had a lot to catch up on very quickly. Because they were like, oh, I'm planning on going to uni here and studying this. And I was like, oh, I hadn't even thought as far ahead as university. I have no clue what I want to do. But I was very lucky that even...
Because you would have just gone back to and finished school then.
Yeah. So I was year 12, 12. So I was in my last couple years of school. I just trying to get through those. Honestly, year 12 is a mammoth for anyone who's done year 12 or is currently doing year 12. That's a mammoth year in itself, just on the academic side. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to get through that whilst also like rejoining the like social scene and trying to figure out what I wanted to do in the fast approaching after school area. So that was, it was so much fun. I got to like, I went on a walk on the beach with my sisters, and like we sat down and like had like conversations. And I feel like one of the things that, it sounds so sad, but I laughed. I could laugh again. I hadn't laughed properly at something in over 2 years, because anytime I did, I ended up in a coughing fit. So I think we were just sitting around the coffee table at home watching bad reality TV, And one of my sisters said something hilarious and I just lost it. I was just rolling on the floor laughing. And then I stopped and they were all kind of looking at me a little shell-shocked. And I was like, what's going on? And they're like, we haven't heard you do that in years. And it was, those first couple months were just...
Those moments are just priceless, aren't they?
They were magical. Like, I went on a trip with some of my really close school friends over to Waiheke for 2 days, something that I couldn't have done beforehand. And because I couldn't go anywhere without this pump, that pump, this meds, these meds, if this happens, take that one. Like, I couldn't go anywhere without them. And for the first time, I literally called mom. It was 11 o'clock at night. And I was like, hey, can I go to Waiheke with Jamie tomorrow for 2 days? And she was like, sure.
I think you can. That's it.
You can now. And like, I did things like that. And I was, there's so much happened within those 2 months. But also within that first 3 months, we probably one of the harder bits of that, the fairy tale definitely wore away for a few days because we did also lose Bob during that time. So after my first month, I had that first clinic and we got all the numbers and my lung function had jumped up and my weight was good and I was looking so much healthier. I didn't have the big gray bags and I was like brighter and more alert and there, because when you can't breathe, it affects every part of yourself. Like, you're not thinking very clearly or very straight, and it's very easy to get into very negative mental spaces because you don't have the ability to think about things and think about things fully. So feelings and everything become so all-encompassing. And my doctors even said, like, you just sound like you are happier in yourself. And I definitely was. And we sort of packaged up all my numbers and all my files and we sent it to Bob. And that was the last time I heard from him, was after he got that. He sort of emailed back and he was like, this looks amazing. I can go now. There is something that is there to help. And that's all he wanted. Would he have loved to have been the one who found the cure? Oh, of course he would. But his goal the entire time was to help.
Yeah.
Was to find a thing that was going to help, to make the lives of people with these chronic illnesses better. And knowing that there was something out there that could do that is all he had ever wanted. And once he saw that it worked and he saw it work for his own eyes, I think there was definitely an element of peace that came from his life work was not in vain. There has been something that has come out of it that can do everything he had ever dreamed of, finding something that could do that. Yeah. And he passed 2 weeks later. That was a hard day to lose him. In a way, I felt when he purchased me the Trikafta and gave me that second shot, I felt a huge responsibility to step into his shoes in a way and be that advocate for the CF community that he had always been. And I think I came out into the living room and I looked over at my mum and she went, okay, he's gone. He passed. And this is still in 2020. We were still in lockdown. We couldn't go and see Betsy or his kids. I had lost people before and it affects you, but him being so influential in that chapter of my life, and for him to never have seen me in person or seen everything that I wanted him to see that I could do now was so challenging. You don't know where to put yourself. I didn't know where to put myself, and I think I cried for like 2 days. I just sat there and everything. I would take a breath or I would run down here or there or go walk up and get a coffee and be like, I am doing this because of Bob. I am here right now because of him. Yeah. I don't know what you can say. He was such a presence. He was such a life force. Like, he would just give you the, like, sly smile and you would know something absolutely mischievous is going through his head, but he wouldn't tell you.
Yeah.
And he would, we had to do a bunch of photo shoots when I was little, and I think he kept harassing the photographer.
Oh, I think I've seen those.
Because I was on a medication that meant I couldn't be in the sun.
Oh, okay.
And he was like, oh, hurry up. We've got to hurry up. We've got nice pictures. I want a cup of tea inside and Bella has to get out of the sun. So he was just.
I think I've seen those pictures in the story. They showed them, didn't they, from when you were younger. That's lovely memories to have of him as well. But, yeah, so much on your shoulders and, you know, such a roller coaster for anybody, never mind such a young person. But so moving on from, I mean, obviously Bob will always be with you and you'll carry that grief, but you're also carrying this whole new life and experience, and you're currently in Sydney working in theatre. How have you ended up? So talk from the girl we met a few years ago on TV who just started Drag After, who's now working in, are you stage manager? What are you doing in theatre?
I'm a wardrobe technician, so I work with the costumes.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I love it.
How has this happened? How have we got here?
How has this happened? So I was a performer as a kid. You know, I loved putting on my costume and going on stage and singing and dancing and doing that. It was such an escape for me for years. But, you know, when your lungs start going, singing and dancing becomes things that you can't do anymore. So I went to Kristen School, which was very lucky to be there. And they're a huge performing arts school. There was 3 big musicals a year. So I retreated into the backstage side of it as a way to still be a part of it, but not be on stage. And I ended up in the wardrobe department on my first show I did as a crew. It was Chicago the Musical. I still don't know what happens in Chicago. But, you know, it was a great time. One of the teachers at our school was like, cool. So her name was Leslie. I worked for her and her company through my entire time. I was sick. They, amazing woman. She was like, okay, you're going to be in our wardrobe department. And I was like, got you. I've got this. It was actually during that show that I got told I had 2 years left to live. I had left the rehearsal of one of them the night before opening. And I had gone to this meeting and I'd been told, hey, you have 2 years. And I remember thinking, because it was that day I had been, you know, doing the rehearsals for the show and I'd just made my first costume plot and done my first like 45-second quick change, and it, like, the adrenaline rush and the everything was there and I loved it. And I was like, I want to do this. I want to do this for the rest of my life. I want to be in this environment. And then I went to that meeting that afternoon and they're like, hey, you have 2 years. And it's a hard thing to hear that your life is ending, but what a way to hear it on the day where you had decided, hey, I know what I want to do with my life. And then hearing you're not going to have one. I went in the very next day. Me and mum had kind of just spent the day together that day. And she's like, you don't have to go. You don't have to go in. You don't have to be a part of it. And I was like, no, I was shaking and crying and like trying so hard to hold myself together. But I knew I needed to have that escape and to be in that other world during that day. And I walked in there and only one close friend knew what I had left to do. And he looked at me across one of the green rooms and he just kind of looked at me and he was like, good. And I shook my head. He came and gave me a hug and I was like, okay, I've got to get through this. And because I had been very much in denial about how bad I was before that meeting.
Yeah. And I think that's quite normal to be that way from what I hear from other
people. I thought it was just a blip in the road and I was going to get better. And it was, but then that meeting made it very clearly obvious that I wasn't. And I did that show and then it did become the thing that I lived for, was theatre. I want to live to see this next show. I want to live to be on the backstage of this one. And my first professional show was actually my Make-A-Wish.
Oh, wow.
So I worked on Warhorse in 2019 when that came through the Civic
I went to Theater. That. It was so good.
Oh, it was beautiful.
I was pregnant then. Hang on. Yeah, I must have been
2019.
Pregnant with Orson. So Orson was born 2019. And I remember being really terrified because Warhorse is so loud. And we were like second row. And so I was like cuddling my belly. So I must have been quite pregnant then.
I was originally just there to like be backstage and see it. And I was working with a girl who went to Kristen. So she knew me and our family. And her brother was in my sister's year. Her name was Freya. Freya like showed me the ropes and showed me what I was doing, and I was her little shadow for a week. And then one of the actual dressers, which is the title of the job I do, you dress people, make sure they're in costumes, was sick, and they needed someone to cover her plot or what she does at a show, and they gave it to me. And the assistant head of wardrobe, he followed me around for the first show, showed me what I was doing, and then said, "You good?" And he left me to it, and I did. I dressed my first professional show. I was this little 15, 16-year-old wandering around backstage. Imagine like a 4'11" person, like dressed all in black, dressing these performers who were all the way, all above my head. It was probably a very funny sight for anyone who worked on that show. And that head of wardrobe, she came up to me on my last day. She's like, "You're very good. Like you can do this. You're very capable of doing this." And it was her saying that to me that I was like, "I am going to make the most of this while I still can." So then I did the production of Les Mis. When that came through, I did that. I did Mary Poppins when that came through in 2020, which was actually after I started Trikafta, thinking about it now. But when I did Les Mis, I was in hospital. I was in hospital during run. I was leaving hospital
to go and
with my IV line in, like I shoved it in a pocket and stitched the pocket up and went to the show and dressed the show and then went back to the ward between shows to swap over the pump. And
so when that person was off sick and you got to step in, you're like, "I'm not having a day off sick. I'm going in."
No sick days for me.
No sick days for you.
Even when I had the oxygen deprived headache and everything hurt and I could feel a pound of concrete on my chest, I absolutely blinkers on. I was like, "I just have to be there. I have to be there in the world where dreams are possible and anything can happen." And it's just,
I saw all of those shows. They're all big productions here in Auckland. Mm. So that was Civic Theatre and Bruce Mason. Was Mary Poppins Bruce Mason? I can't remember.
Mary Poppins was the Civic, I think, in the end. It was supposed to be at the Bruce Mason.
Yeah, it was the Civic. Because it might have got put off, maybe. I can't remember.
Got put off because of COVID and then ended up in the Civic. And I had done...
Civic is just the best. I'd imagine that's like the best place to work.
It's the best place to work unless you have bad lungs because it's all built on stairs.
Oh, right. So was, not so good for you.
It was a challenge, but...
Amazing experience.
All those challenges were so worth it. So I did those sorts of shows. But then once 2020 hit, I thought I had done my law. I think Adam's Family was the last one I did. And I was like, okay, that's it. Ending on a high, ending on a show I really enjoyed. And then I got on Trikafta, and of course I could picture a future again. And I was like, okay, I'm going to push for this now. This has been the thing that has kept me going, but also the thing that has made me believe that there can, like, life can be magical and life can be whatever you make it. And it sounds like such a corny theater kid thing to say that, like, the theater is the thing that made me believe like life is worth living. But you can work on those sorts of shows and the stories that they tell and just the creative, gorgeous, beautiful people that work on them. Just, it's such a smorgasbord of like the weirdest, wonderful experiences and people that just make it oh, just so worth it. The long hours and everything are just so worth it.
Did you get a job in Australia or did you move? Did you sort of take a punt and just move? Oh, you got a job.
I moved to keep working.
Yeah.
So I finished high school at the end of 2021, and through the end of 2020 and 2021, I worked on everything and anything that came through. My big one, my first professional show, sort of off my own back, because I'd been doing pro-am, so professional, amateur, youth theatre, different small theatre companies I'd worked with. And then Lion King came through in 2021.
That's huge.
That was the first one. Yeah, that was my first one I got onto off my own merit and off the CV that I had painstakingly worked so hard to get, and, you know, taking sneaky days off school here and there just to, like, be at that rehearsal. And I worked Lion King, and it was that show will always hold a very, very special place in my heart.
So you would have been on TriCafter then when you were doing Lion King?
I was on TriCafter at that point. I was still self-funding at that point. So we were all very much still unsure of how much time I was having on it. So I was just living life to the fullest and going for it. I got to see the show from the best seat in the house every night, standing in the wings, watching the Circle of Life. It was so incredibly beautiful. And it was after that show that I got accepted onto the managed access scheme, which then made doing what I'm doing now so much easier.
Yeah, so you knew, so the managed access scheme with Vertex meant that people were funded in New Zealand who were very much in need. So how did you end up in Oz? Like, did you, so you got the managed access, so you kind of felt free, you know you're on TriCafter, you know that you're going to be okay.
So I graduated high school and then was like, okay, maybe I don't jump headfirst into this. Maybe I go get a degree. So I did 6 months at Toi Whakaari, the New Zealand Drama School. And then I was working on a production of The Wedding Singer that was touring from Australia that had come through Welly. One of the beautiful performers on that went, do you want to do this professionally? Like, would you ever move to Australia to keep doing this? And I very much throwaway comment went, yeah, no, I'd love to. Turned around, kept doing my job. And then she comes up to me the next day. It's the middle of a quick change. And she goes, oh, there's a job on my next show. Do you want me to put you forward for it? And I went, oh, like, when does it start? And she's like, oh, like 2 weeks from now. And it was one of those moments where you just say yes. You just say yes. And I didn't think I was going to get the job. And I was like, I'm not going to get the job. I'm just going to say yes. And it's going to be a funny story I tell at Christmas.
Mm.
Then 2 days later, I got a call saying, hey, you've got the job. You start in just over 2 weeks. And I was like, okay. Like, it was only supposed to be a three-month contract, and then I'd come back and I'd work and chill for the rest of the year and then go back to uni. Like, just didn't think, said yes, called mum and dad. I was like, hey, so I'm moving to Australia for 3 months. And just kind of spat it out.
And that'll be fine.
And it'll be fine. It'll be great. So I, you know, I packed up my life in Wellington, moved it home to Auckland, moved to Sydney, worked on that show. Sadly, that show came to a close a lot earlier than expected. And I was like, okay, I still have like 2 months, 2-3 months. Let's try and get on something else and just make the most of this stint of time. And I ended up on Phantom of the Opera at the Opera House. That was just magnificent. And I met some of my closest friends now, because it was also coming to Australia was the first time that I could really branch out as Bella and not Bella with CF, because no one knew me before. I could be completely and authentically me, and that of course did come with a lot of mental challenges. My first, even though I was doing the thing I love and working in the industry that I love, I definitely, that was the first time I had felt like truly free from the me who was so defined by her CF. It was, has been a really difficult adjustment going, unpacking a lot of the things that I never thought I would have time to unpack about my experience with CF and my feelings that I must succeed first try every time because I'm not going to have time to succeed again. So it's definitely been a huge adjustment, like,
that's a whole new thing that opens up that, you know, that I've read quite a bit about with looking after people with CF, although we've got this treatment and modulator drugs now, just that mental effect and looking after people's well-being, because it does open up. Like you said, you'd kind of in your head had decided, well, you know, I'm out soon, so this is who I am, this is what I've done. And you're sort of processing that, and then suddenly it's not over. And, you know, having gone through what you've gone through, I mean, I have a very different experience to you, but there's something about when your eyes have been open to certain things, some other things can become very... You don't have the patience for them, basically,
yeah.
Because you think, well, actually, this is not me. So that kind of puts you on a different level. What I wanted to end on, because I always do the What's CF moment, and I kind of wanted to make the What's CF moment something that you could say to young adults or teenagers with CF about goals and ambitions, because obviously everyone has a different journey, but especially with the futures we're looking at now with CF, I wondered if you wanted to kind of give a What the CF moment advice piece, just put you up there on a pedestal there, you know, with what you've done and achieved and the work you're doing in Australia and continuing to work in theatre and building this amazing career. What would you say to teenagers or young people with CF listening to this who are awaiting a treatment, and it might not be Trikafta, not everyone can take it?
I guess, so I've been here 7 months and I've worked on Phantom and Moulin Rouge, and now I'm working on Hairspray. And I think be open to every opportunity, like take the leaps of faith when they come to you, even if maybe you don't feel like you're up to it. I think that's the big thing that I always told myself, is never push yourself too far, but always push yourself to imagine the life that you want, and don't be afraid to take it with both hands, especially now that there are treatments in place and things. Modern medicine is amazing, and we're at a place now, especially with Trikafta. When I heard that was coming through, the first thing that came to my mind is now the next generation of people with CF do not have to think about their life in the next day, the next hour, the next second, the next breath. You can search for the future you want and push have the future you not only want to have but deserve to have, because your CF does not define you, you define what it means to you. And that's something my mum has told me my entire life. Your CF is not a part of you, it is not who you are, it will always be something that you have and something that you have battled with and struggled with and fought with. But now is the time where you can stop fighting your CF and instead fight for yourself, fight for what you want, fight for your future. And whatever your dream is, maybe it's something in the arts, or you want to do med, or you want to do law, do whatever you want to do, you can. There's nothing stopping you. I am a big writer. So I, whenever something big happens in my life, I write big sections of how I'm feeling and different things. And when you were asking me about something inspirational to say, I went back to what I wrote on the day that I was told Trikafta was getting funded. And I actually think this is probably the most cohesive thought I've ever had about living with CF and dreaming for a future. So I was the kid who loved fairy tales. I used to watch princesses magically transform and live these amazing lives full of love, happiness, freedom, and magic, but realistically knew I would never get that. That's a hard thing to grow up knowing, but Trikafta means that the next generation of Kiwis born with CF will never have to experience that. They will get to live the lives they deserve and choose their own path without thinking of CF as their greatest limitation. And I was like, that's pretty much encompasses what these treatments mean.
Bella Powell, thank you so much for sharing everything with you. And I know a lot of it is not lovely to go over, so I really appreciate you sharing it, because it means so much to all of us, and we appreciate so much what you've done.
Because it must be a huge emotional thing with you, with your son, even though I've had to go through what I've gone through, knowing that your son is not going to have to do that, is not going to have to experience his life looking out a hospital window, is such it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I just appreciate you sharing everything, because it's so important for other people and other young people, because, you know, you don't know where life's going to take you. you don't know what's going to happen. And I think the way that you've dealt with things and the way that you're able to articulate the experiences that you've had and the ambitions and goals that you've got is very unique to, you know, to any community, to any person, really. So we're just very lucky to be able to share these share these times with you and hear your story. And yeah, no, I just really appreciate it. So that's why I get, you know, it's a lot to hear about it, but it's appreciative and happiness that I'm kind of expressing. But yeah. I'm just really happy for you that you're doing all this stuff and appreciate you sharing it. And sorry for sorry for crying at the end.
Oh my God, no. Usually I'm the one crying, so.
No, you're amazing. But yeah, I can't thank you enough, though, for coming on and sharing everything. And I wish you all the best. And I follow you on Instagram, so I'm always excited because I'm a big theatre person as well. So I'm always like, ah! So I'm so excited for you to carry on your career, really.
Thank you.